Although few people have had personal encounters with sharks, nonetheless, sharks loom large in the popular imagination. Today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about the realities of sharks, their evolution and biology, and their extraordinary importance to all life in the world's oceans, and to the life of the planet as well. And joining me for the discussion are Dr. Melanie Stiassny, the Axelrod Research Curator of Fishes in the Department of Ichthyology at the American Museum of Natural History, one of the people responsible for the museum's magnificent Hall of Oceans Life, and Dr. John Mazey, Curator of the Axelrod Research Chair in the Division of Paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History. Welcome to our show.
Hi.
Hi, hello.
And this turns out to be a lot more timely than we'd expected because sharks are in the news. For the first time, a ban on shark fishing in the Western Pacific is being put into place today. Melanie, why was that even necessary?
Oh, that is so timely, and it's such good news. I mean, sharks are really in serious trouble.
Well, we don't tend to think of sharks as being the ones who need to be protected.
Yeah, I know. When you think of shark, what's the second word that comes to your mind, right? Attack, shark attack. In fact, sharks really have attacked very few people, and compared to something like bees or spiders, it's insignificant. Yes, so we think of sharks as being these terrible predators. They're out there, and they're so powerful, and we're so timid, and what have you. In fact, it's completely the other way around. Sharks really have a lot to worry about with us. We are, if you just look at their population numbers, in the last 25 years, many shark populations have declined 90%.
Is it because of sport fishing, or are there other reasons?
No, there are many other reasons. I mean, sport fishing is really a drop in the ocean. We're looking at two major threats to sharks, and one is bycatch. You know, now we have these massive longline fishing fleets all over the world's oceans. Many, many, many sharks get caught on those longlines, and they just die in huge numbers. The other thing that's become increasingly critical is the so-called finning. So this is really the market of sharks for fins, for their fins.
For shark fin soup?
Exactly, for shark fin soup, which it's kind of crazy because the fins are cartilage. Cartilage has no taste and very little nutritive value, so it's really just a kind of tradition. Yet that tradition is causing the slaughter of literally millions of sharks a year.
Do they kill a whole shark just to get the fin?
Sadly, they do. And just in a horrible twist, they'll just strip the fins off the shark and throw the living animal back into the ocean.
And can they survive without that?
No, they absolutely can't. They bleed to death or they drown.
What about mako sharks, which appear on many restaurant menus?
Similar issues for makos. One of the fastest swimmers in the ocean, just a glorious animal. The finning of sharks is indiscriminate. All sharks, as we're going to talk about, have this cartilaginous skeleton, so any fin will do.
John, among other things, you study the origins and evolution of sharks, and we try to go back to basics or to the beginnings in these Please Explain segments. So what is a shark? What distinguishes it from other fish?
Well, sharks are cartilaginous fishes, as their name implies, the chondrichthyan fishes, the cartilage fishes. They really don't have large bones in their skeletons like the bony fish do, the osteichthyans. So we have, instead, they have a cartilage skeleton, the vertebrae and the bones supporting, or the skeleton supporting the fins and the skull, is all cartilage. Having said that, though, it is quite resilient and hard because it does have minerals deposited within the cartilage, but it's not bone like we're used to. And so sharks have been around for over 400 million years, and we know that they've had this kind of skeleton for most of that time.
Do they descend from bony fishes?
Well, they probably did. When we sort of study the earliest ones, we discover that they're actually quite similar to bony fish, apart from the absence of the bones. And, there are different opinions about how they're actually related to each other, but I think the general consensus today is that they were originally bony and they've lost the bone early in their evolution.
And I gather that it's hard to study shark fossils because they don't have bones. Cartilage disappears.
It is difficult because they are such rare fossils. The fossil record of sharks is really, there are two components to it. One is their teeth, which are unbelievably abundant, and they're hard and resilient, and they fossilize very well. And so we have thousands and thousands of their teeth. We know quite a lot about the evolution of sharks' teeth. But the actual anatomy of the beast itself, its internal skeleton and its anatomy, is very poorly known because they very rarely preserve as fossils.
Now, Melanie, I've heard again and again that sharks are considered to be very successful creatures in evolutionary terms.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they're endangered for other reasons, but why have they been so successful evolutionarily?
Right. Well, clearly they have, if you look at it in terms of the kind of longevity of the lineage, as John said, you know, the first shark fossils we know from back over 400 million years
ago. Well, what does that mean? Is that I said earlier they predate dinosaurs.
Oh, way predate dinosaurs, yeah.
But what was on Earth other than at that time?
Well, interestingly, there were what we would call fishes around. A lot of those fishes didn't have jaws that we know about, but they were bony. They had bony coverings and, you know, giant sea scorpion-like things. So there was a lot of big stuff in the oceans when those early sharks were around. But one thing that's kind of interesting is because you have this group that has this very, very long genealogy going back 400 million years. But in fact, most of the sharks that are alive today, the ones that we're eating in shark's fin soup and that are having so many problems, most of those actually evolved really very recently, about the same time as mammals and birds and that sort of thing. So there's this modern radiation of sharks. So
yeah,
that the
if I could just interrupt.
Please do, John.
I'd agree with Melanie because all the modern sharks and rays that we have today, their earliest relatives are from the early Jurassic period, which is the time of the dinosaurs, around, you know, 200 million years or less. So less than half, all of the modern diversity has arisen in only half of the time that sharks have been around.
Now, you mentioned rays. Are sharks and rays related, John?
Yes, they are. They're actually quite closely related, and there are some fossils that kind of bridge the gap between them. Today, they obviously look very different. Their rays are very flat and strange and not at all shark-like. But there are some very primitive shark rays today that do look a bit shark-like. And they seem to have diverged sometime in the Jurassic period, about 180 million years ago.
My guests are Dr. John Masey and Dr. Melanie Stiassny, both of the American Museum of Natural History. We're talking about sharks on today's Please Explain. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Later we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment and a question on our show page at WNYC.org. John, what are some of the more interesting characteristics of sharks beyond the fact that they are largely cartilage?
Sharks are, of course, a very ancient group, and people tend to think of them as sort of unevolved. But as Melanie mentioned, you know, the modern diversity has arisen over the last couple of hundred million years, so they've evolved in their own way in a number of different directions.
Well, the oceans have changed, so have they evolved in response to what has come after them?
Well, they've certainly evolved alongside other fishes, the bony fishes especially. So, for example, the rise of all the modern groups of sharks more or less coincides with the rise of many of the modern groups of bony fishes too, the ray fin fishes especially. So their evolution was probably linked in some fashion.
Can they smell? Can they hear?
Oh, yes. They have an extremely sensitive sense of smell. The olfaction is very sensitive. So it's well known that sharks can track, very diluted traces of blood in the water for miles and miles. And they also have a very interesting, modern sharks have an extremely unusual sense of hearing. They can actually detect extremely low-frequency sound anywhere between 100 and 1,000 hertz, which is extremely low wavelength, through a modification of their inner ear. So they're not using the ear in the way that we do with our inner ear. They've actually modified some of their organ of balance, the semicircular canals, so that they can detect low-frequency sound.
And what does that low-frequency sound do for them?
Well, they can detect prey at some distance, making low-frequency vibrations in the water. And they can detect the direction, which is something we can't do. If you think about it, if you go out and buy a fancy stereo system, you only get one subwoofer, and that's because we can feel or hear bass sound, but we can't detect direction. So having it in stereo wouldn't be any point to it. But sharks can actually detect the direction of sound at low frequencies using this apparatus in their inner ear. So they can detect if something is behind them, in front of them, or to the left or to the right.
Can I just interject also? Yeah, I mean, John's so right about the sensory abilities of sharks, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that they live in water, and that's something that we tend to forget because we live on land, and when we go in water, you know, we can't see properly, we certainly can't smell, and sound is just like a cacophony. But water is this dense, incompressible fluid. It's a viscous medium. So sharks have really been able to optimize on that. So not only are they able to, as John said, have a great sense of smell, they've got this great sense of low frequency hearing, which in water, those frequencies travel a long, long distances. But also think about it. Water is a great conductor of electricity. And sharks have a fantastic ability to detect electric fields. So they can actually, and a number of them will do this, they can actually find their fish prey that's buried under the sand using electricity.
Under the sand?
Under the sand, yeah. Because the fish under the sand is generating an electric field, and the shark can detect that. Because it's living in water. Another thing they can do is they have a sense of distant touch. Bony fishes have this too. It's the lateral line system and the sensory canals on their heads. If I wave to you in the air, you have to see me wave. If you were a shark and you were in the water, I could wave and you would feel it. You wouldn't have to see it. So living in water really opens up a lot of sensory opportunities. And have sharks ever taken up those opportunities?
Now, I've heard that some shark species bear live young. I always thought that all fish lay eggs.
Oh, good heavens. Not at all. In fact, with sharks and rays, the great majority of them give birth to live young. And when you think about shark reproduction, you're really talking about superlatives, just some of the most extraordinary adaptations that in many interesting ways mirror what we mammals have done. I mean, we give birth to live young. We provide through the woman's placenta food for the young in the uterus. Many sharks do that, only they do it in the oviducts.
John, you mentioned that sharks can smell blood from a far distance, and I've always heard sharks were dangerous if you were bleeding and swimming in the water. Is that where they get their reputation for being so dangerous, or are they likely to attack humans who are not bleeding?
I think that the majority of shark attacks, which are, of course, in warmer waters, are largely due to the fact that that's where people like to go swimming. We are invading their territory, as it were, and I think that a lot of shark attacks are brought on really just by the shark getting annoyed at this intrusion that maybe the swimmer is completely unaware of.
Sharks can swim better than us, they can smell better than us, they can do everything better than us in water. If sharks really wanted to eat people, believe me, no one would be able to go into the oceans. Sharks do not see humans as their prey.
Which ones are the more dangerous shark species for humans? Are they the large ones of the sort that... Well, Jaws, of course, is the...
The great white.
That's not really true to nature, but how big do they grow?
Great whites, it's very hard to get an absolute definitive size, but up to 20 feet in length.
Wow. And what are the smaller sharks?
The smallest known shark, I believe, is a little dogfish in the Caribbean. It's 8 inches and very cute.
And are they very similar, except for the fact that they're of different size?
No. That's a kind of another misconception people have, that a shark is a shark is a shark. But the diversity in sharks is just extraordinary. The difference from this little 8-inch dogfish to the giant whale shark of, you know, over 50 feet in length, hugely different. It's as different as an elephant is to an opossum.
John, in your studies of shark evolution, has that always been the case, that we've had those teeny little ones and the huge ones?
Yes, it is, actually. I was just thinking that there are actually some extinct sharks which are even smaller than the smallest modern ones. There's some from the Triassic period and from the Cretaceous, so anywhere between, 200 and 100 million years ago, that were only about 4 or 5 or 6 inches long, and these are fully developed, mature individuals. So furthermore, they were actually not living in the oceans. They actually lived in lakes and rivers.
So there are freshwater sharks?
There are today, a few, and in the past there seemed to be quite a number of them. So different groups of sharks too.
John, can I ask about the largest shark is the whale shark, right, at about 50 feet. What about in the fossil record?
The fossil record would be the great megalodon with its 6-inch blade teeth, which is a relative of the white shark, although some people argue, about which modern shark it's more closely related to. But that would certainly seem to be the largest that we are aware of. There were plenty of sharks, though, that would have been, 10 or 11 feet long back in the age of dinosaurs. We have teeth that are certainly comparable with that kind of length.
It's interesting that you brought that up, because a listener who just hung up upon hearing you say that was going to ask you whether the museum had any fossils of the megalodon.
Well, we have their teeth, yes. I think most of the major museums have quite large collections of their teeth, because they are quite common, and when you see them, there's no mistaking them. They're gigantic, triangular, blade-like things with a serrated edge.
So we can extrapolate the rest of their size from the size of their teeth?
Pretty much. The tooth size versus body size is more or less consistent, and we do actually have a few fossil jaws of the great white shark, the megalodon, so we can actually judge the size of the jaw versus the size of the teeth, and we can estimate up from that.
Now, why would they need such huge jaws and such huge teeth? Most fish are fairly small, even the bigger ones, the tuna and the salmon. I don't know if they go back to the time of the megalodon.
Yeah, they do. Yes.
Even they're not all that big.
No, but actually one of the interesting things about some of the strata where we find the megalodon teeth also contain quite large numbers of bones of whales and dolphins. And probably these white sharks were actually hunting these marine mammals as their prey. And it's interesting that about, if you go back about 15, 20 million years, not so far back in geological time, the time of Megalodon, there were many very large sharks that are related to modern ones. So there were also Mako sharks, which were much larger than the modern ones, and tiger sharks as well. So it just seems that a lot of sharks back then were just bigger than they are today, although they were just closely related species, but they were sort of a bit bigger.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking calls from our listeners at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And my guests are Dr. John Macy, curator and Axelrod Research Chair in the Division of Paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History, and Dr. Melanie Stiasny, the Axelrod Research Curator of Fishes in the Department of Ichthyology at the American Museum of Natural History, one of the people responsible for the museum's magnificent Hall of Oceans Life. Stay with us for more. We're talking about sharks on today's Please Explain segment with Drs. Melanie Stiasny and John Mazey, both of the American Museum of Natural History. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Let's get right to some of those calls, and we'll begin with, who is this? This is John from Paramus, New Jersey. Hi, John.
You don't recognize me? I'm shocked. But anyway, because I call all the time. I want to know about the myth that sharks have to keep swimming and moving, otherwise they'll sink. Is that true or false?
It's pretty much false. Some sharks do keep moving a lot. Other sharks can spend a lot of time sitting on the bottom just hanging out. So the sharks that sit on the bottom just hanging out tend to be able to ventilate their gills. So they can draw air in through a little hole in the head, and then the water passes over their gills and then out of the gill slits, and they're fine. Actually, it's kind of interesting that sharks, unlike bony fishes, don't have a gas-filled bladder in them. But most bony fishes have a gas bladder that's filled with air, and they can use it to go up and down in the water column. Sharks don't have that. That's, again, one of the features that differentiates them from bony fishes. So that means they're kind of heavy, and they're hanging in the water. You know, they get a tendency to sink. So the way they get around that is to sequester oil in their livers. So sharks have very, very oily livers, but that gives them buoyancy.
And we hope that answers your question. I've always thought that they had to move. I think I must have read that a million times during my life. Now I know it's not true, like so many things we've been told. Turns out to not be true.
If you sit in an aquarium, if you go and watch an aquarium tank, you know, a big one with sharks, you'll sometimes see them sitting on the bottom, especially some of these nurse sharks and carpet sharks. They just like to sit quietly on the bottom, and all you can see is the gills moving. They're not swimming at all.
Well, the subject of sharks obviously attracts women with names like Melanie, because on the line with us now is Melanie from Connecticut. Hi, Melanie.
Hi. Yes, I'm particularly interested in sharks because I grew up in the subtropical climate of Durban, South Africa, in the warm waters of the Indian Ocean, where I remember there being frequent shark attacks. And if we were in the water and seaweed brushed against us, we ran out of the water as quickly as possible. And I also remember shark attacks at least once a year, somebody losing a leg or dying. But maybe that's just a wrong recollection. But my question has to do with what we heard about how sharks were trapped. We could swim in certain waters because there were shark nets put out to sea. And we were told that the sharks swam in through the sides, but they were trapped going back out to sea. And I don't know if that's an old wives' tale or if, in fact, it really did happen, that the sharks didn't come... You know, they did come past the nets, but instead of coming into the shore, they got confused somehow, and trying to get back out to sea, that's when they got trapped. And I believe now that the system is no longer used because of concern for the population of sharks.
John, do you want to take that, or shall I?
I don't know that much about the shark netting. Except that it doesn't seem like a very efficient system to protect swimmers if it lets the sharks in. I'm just wondering how that was supposed to work in the first place. I don't know. Melanie, do you know if these shark nets are still used to protect beaches?
I think they are in places, yeah. But I don't know what Melanie's actually referring to about this trapping the sharks. I think when shark nets are used now, they really are just to keep the sharks out from being close to shore. But just to get back to Melanie's point about the attacks, and I mean, there are global records of shark attacks, so that we know pretty much how many people are attacked by sharks over time, and it's actually surprisingly few. I'm going to say about 30 a year in the U.S. Now that sounds like a lot, but in fact, none of those resulted in death this year. And I think in 2007, one person died as a result of a shark attack, and that was in New Caledonia in the Pacific. It's really overblown, and the music we're hearing from Jaws, you know, that whole hysteria mm-hmm. about sharks, I think has actually had a horrendously detrimental effect about how people view sharks.
Was Jaws a big hit in South Africa, Melanie?
Well, I actually lived in the United States when Jaws came out. So I grew up in the 50s and 60s, long before Jaws. And sharks in subtropical waters were a very big issue. It had nothing to do with Jaws. It really was a real threat, whether it was perceived or an actual threat, because, you know, every now and then in the newspaper was a picture of a lovely person or a surfer or somebody who had been attacked by a shark.
Yeah.
So, you know, it could have been because of the warm waters in what is now KwaZulu-Natal. But there were certain beaches that you risked your life when you swam there.
Well, I thank you for calling us. There's another listener who also wants to talk about South Africa. It's kind of interesting that that one area gets discussed. Is that because there are more sharks there in that part of the world? Well, first let's hear from this caller, Marisa from New Jersey.
Yes, hi. My name is Marisa. Last year I went to visit South Africa, and I was where the water, the Pacific Ocean, meet with the Atlantic Ocean. And as I was walking by the water with my husband, who happened to be a veterinarian, we saw a baby shark, a tiny, about 2 feet baby shark. And I told my husband, let's try to pick the shark and drop it into the ocean, because I wanted the shark to stay alive. And as my husband approached the baby shark, tried to take the shark, the baby shark opened its mouth as wide as possible. I guess it was a way to protect himself. I don't know. So my husband dropped it into the ocean. But my question is, for a shark as tiny, are the baby sharks also a danger for human, a danger to human being, or what's going on with the tiny baby shark to be as aggressive as I saw the one there?
No, I don't think you need to be scared of tiny baby sharks. It's actually really kind of interesting that sharks do give birth to live young. When I said that,
are they the only fish that do that?
No, there are some bony fish that do it, but the majority of sharks do it. So that makes it it's the standard reproductive mode for sharks. So if you give birth to live young, well, what you do is you invest a lot of energy into producing a few individual young. So that makes you, the young are born pretty much like miniature adults, and that's why they're able to open their jaws and snap around. They can feed the minute they're born.
But it would also ensure that more of the young would survive.
That's exactly right, and that's the strategy. It's like, you know, you invest a lot in a few, or you invest a little in a lot.
Do sharks then become maternal?
No, there's no evidence of parental care by sharks. They do all of the caring for their young inside their bodies. So the female will nourish the young inside her body, and then she gives birth to it. They're birthed in such an advanced state that they can immediately go out into the ocean and start eating.
John, you want to add anything, or should I go to the next question?
I believe that there are some reports of sharks actually feeding before they're born. There are some of these records of cannibalistic behavior of baby sharks while they're still inside the mother. They're eating the, they're eating each other, kind of thing. I'm not sure how true that is, but I think there are some records of this.
Yeah, definitely. That's
with white sharks.
You know, the sand tigers and or the gray nurse does that. And it's a great strategy. The first couple of pups that hatch then eat the unhatched pups, or they'll eat the unhatched eggs, or they'll eat the other unhatched pups.
Now, a listener, Adam, left a question on our show page. Has anyone ever tested those electric shark repelling devices for surfers? Do they work?
Well, I haven't.
No, I haven't tested them either, but I know there has been a lot of research into that. I don't think they work. I don't know.
Dax in Monmouth County, New Jersey, left a question on our show page. He says, I am 8 years old and reading lots of books on sharks. Where do most sharks live in the world, and do they migrate?
Oh, what a great question.
Yeah.
Well, it takes an 8-year-old to think of the question that we all should have asked.
You're absolutely right. Yes, some do migrate. The great white, for example. There are records of it. Because we can now tag them with satellite tags, so we can actually track where they're going and what they're doing. And they travel huge distances, thousands and thousands of miles. So some do and others don't. I mean, that's what I was trying to get at with sharks. There's not just a shark. There's so many different kinds of sharks. There's some sharks that probably never leave an area of 100 meters from their home. And there are the big pelagic sharks that spend their whole lives just cruising the world's oceans, traveling thousands of miles in a year.
We go to Bob now from Manhattan. Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Bob, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Oh, my question?
I think you're confused because the radio is on delay.
Okay.
You should turn off the radio. Everyone should turn off the radio when they're calling.
I'll turn off the radio, okay? My question is this.
Bob, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have heard a long time ago that sharks are not fish because fish have scales. I mean, this is what I learned a long time ago, that sharks do not have scales. They have skins of some type, and they are a species all unto themselves, akin to rays, which also are the same type.
Well, we did talk about the similarities between rays and fish. Does that mean that sharks are not really fish?
Well, I wouldn't agree with that. They don't have scales like large, you know, round scales like you see on a fish if you go to the fishmongers. But they have, the skin is covered with little tiny, what are called denticles. They're like very tiny teeth, very closely spaced. But that seems to be yet another specialization of sharks, that they have the skin is covered in little tiny spiny shark denticles, which actually are quite rough. If you stroke the skin of a shark, you know, from nose to tail, it feels relatively smooth. But if you do it the other way, it's very sharp and prickly. In fact, they used to use shark skin as a sandpaper to finish fine furniture, 100 years ago or more. You know, it depends on how you want to define a fish. They all breathe using gills. They all live in the water. They all have the same fins and so on. So their basic anatomy is very similar. Sharks seem to have evolved from other kinds of fishes that probably had they may have had large scales or not. But the shape of a scale doesn't really define whether something is a fish or not.
What about the cartilage? Are there other fish that are mostly cartilaginous?
Yeah, there are a few, like the sturgeons and paddlefish, which are again bony fish that have lost a lot of their bones. They still have some bones, and they're not related directly to sharks, but they do have a largely cartilaginous internal skeleton. But they also have large scales, so that they are different in that respect.
And we also know that they've secondarily lost bone because we have, you know, fossil sturgeons and paddlefish that were fully bony. So the living sturgeons and paddlefish have secondarily reverted back to cartilage.
Yeah, and the other thing about that is in some of the earliest fossil sharks, you do find traces of real bone. It's not extensive, but the skeleton does have some bony tissue in it.
But Tom,
all the indications are that they had bone once and they've lost it.
Tom from Park Slope is calling in. Tom, you have to make it very quick because we have 10 seconds.
What was the name of the geological period when they first evolved?
Devonian. The oldest sharks we've got are really early Devonian.
And what was around at the time?
There were a few other bony fish. There were these armored placoderm fishes with big bony plates all over their head and trunk, and the acanthodians, which had spines sticking out of all their fins.
I want to thank the two of you so much for participating in today's Please Explain About Sharks, Dr. John Mazey of the American Museum of Natural History, and Dr. Melanie Stiazny, also from the museum, one in ichthyology, the other in paleontology. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
It's been great, thanks.
Thank you, it's been a pleasure.
On Monday's show, Peter Moss gives an account of the consequences of our addiction to oil, its impact on places like Venezuela and Nigeria. And then best-selling author Nick Hornby on his latest novel, Juliet Naked. Also, John Peet, the European editor of The Economist, discusses the German election results, the campaigns leading up to the election, and what the outcome means for Germany. Plus, Mackenzie Funk reports on AIG's use of private firefighters to save AIG-insured houses threatened by California's wildfires. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Drew Katchen, Ida Sadakiani, and contributing producer Bonnie LeFave. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.